your bio, you know, what we're doing here, what we're here to talk about, and all that kind of stuff. I have the two questions that I sent to you, and then we'll open it up to the floor for any questions that you might have about the projects that Dr. Benjamin's working on, all that kind of stuff, and then we'll just wrap up with a plug for your case study group,
yes.
And then for the online presence that you have on Friday as well. And then, you know, how people can get in touch with you, because we'd like to be able to put this online so that, you know, Marines can use this for PME discussions or, you know, all that kind of good stuff. So. All right. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. We're here at the TCOM Warfighting Club, and we have Dr. Bruce Goodmanson here with us today. He has a long association with the Armed Forces of the United States, in particular the United States Marine Corps. He served as a Marine enlisted and Marine officer from 1977 to 1997, rising to the rank of major, as I said, truck driver, logistician, infantry officer. And in 1989, the year of the publication of Warfighting, the establishment of McCuff and the CMC reading list, he was recalled to active duty to design the curriculum for School of Advanced Warfighting at Marine Corps University. He's also the author of Stormtroop Tactics on Armor, on Artillery, and the co-author of subsequent editions of On Infantry. He's an advocate of the case method of instruction, and spent 3 years as a case writer at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. Since 2007, he's been a senior fellow for the case method at Marine Corps University, where he has conducted demonstration of the case method, teaches top courses that employ that method, and writes case materials, assisting instructors at the Marine Corps University to incorporate decision-forcing cases into their classes. He's a graduate of Yale College, of Oxford University, and Dr. Goodmanson has taught at the Marine Corps School of Advanced Warfighting, Oxford University, the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst, U.S. Army War College, and Dickinson College. Currently, he's running two different PME groups here at Quantico, both the case study group and then also working on an e-build-on project. And these are some of the things that we're going to talk about today. So, Dr. Goodmanson, welcome.
Well, thank you.
We're pleased to have you here today. So, just to start things off, in your recent essay in 2018 for the Marine Corps University Journal, you mentioned two preceptors who were influential in the maturation and cultivation of Gerhard Scharnhorst, both as a military officer and as a scholar. The first was Count William of Schaumburg-Lippe and his military academy at the fortress of Wilhelmstein, and where he encouraged academic study and experimentation in the science of war. And the second was Destorf, who guided his officers of his cavalry regiment through a rigorous program of war fighting, war gaming, staff rides, and tactical exercises. So in this context, could you discuss your current e-build-on project and how Scharnhorst's experiences in PME influence your work?
Yes, thank you for the very kind introduction. So there's a terrific book out there, which I recommend to all of you, called The Enlightened Soldier. In fact, I spent some time a couple of weeks ago trying to convince the publisher to put it out in a cheaper edition.
Yes,
I failed. The good news is that the author, Charles Edward White, has just retired from the Federal Service and will now be able to devote full time to writing a multi-volume biography of Gerhard von Scharnhorst. But I do recommend, you know, going to the library, borrowing the book from your friends, photocopying to the limit of copyright law, the Enlightened Soldier. And that really, that book focuses on organization very similar to this one, the Military Society of Berlin in the early 1800s. But as good as that book is, I think it only tells half the story. It tells a story of one kind of thought, slow, deliberate, methodical thought, the kind of thought you'll see in the training of engineers, the training of scientists, the training of scholars. it's thinking slow. And yet when you look at both Scharnhorst and his most famous student, Carl von Clausewitz, there's something else there. There's an invisible elephant in the room, if I really mix a metaphor there. There's something else going on. And that something else going on is thinking quickly, thinking on one's feet. And I don't want to make the mistake of, which we sometimes do, of saying, well, if thinking quickly is good, then thinking slowly is bad. These are two mutually complementary types of thinking. And so when I emphasize thinking quickly, it's not because I am denigrating the thinking slowly. Rather, because for a number of essentially accidental reasons, it's a lot easier for us to learn about the slow thinking, because that's the part that's on paper. And the fast thinking is something that we've missed, because it was done so quickly, it didn't get recorded. So there's a lot of literature about Scharnhorst. He's a remarkable character in terms of the way he's remembered, because everybody in Germany since then liked him. Right? He was a hero to the Kingdom of Prussia. He was a hero to the German Empire. He was a hero in the Weimar Republic. He was a hero to the National Socialists. And then after World War II, when Germany splits up, he's a hero in both East and West. This is no mean feat. And now, thanks to large part to the work of Dr. White, he's a hero to the U.S. Marine Corps. Very few characters have that kind of popularity in such a range of fans. So there's a lot of literature about him, and a lot of literature about one of his mentors, William of Schaumburg-Lippe. And William is a remarkable man in many respects, and worthy of our attention, first of all, because he had an integrated view of warfare. Everything from the ethics of warfare down to how do you employ individual cannon. Right, yes, he was a gunner, right? I'm a gunner's in the room are smiling, thank you, yeah. So he is somebody who thinks holistically, thinks completely, but not without paying attention to details. He's not I'm a big picture guy, don't bother me with details. He says, yes, I've got a big picture and I've got details. And of course, it may have been easier to do that in the 18th century than today. I don't know about that. But he was very much a creature of the Enlightenment. His best friend was Moses Mendelssohn, who is the guy who brings the Enlightenment to the Jewish world. Right. So it was a very interesting friendship there. But you can see both of them are very much creatures of their time, emphasizing rationality. They both have great confidence in the ability of human beings to think things through. Of course, thinking things through takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of sitting down with a pencil and a pen and working things out. So what William of Schaumburg-Lippe does, he sets up this academy, which I have described or imagined as a kind of Hogwarts. So you've got, you probably all have Hogwarts, at least an image of Hogwarts on your mind. It's a school, a very picturesque location. It was actually built on an island in a lake. So there's a fortress on an island in a lake, and you have the students walk around in their curious costumes, and they're doing all sorts of interesting experiments. They have very interesting teachers. This school, this military Hogwarts, if you will, was very much geared towards providing engineer and artillery officers, which in the 18th century was the same thing. We hadn't split then, for the small army of Schaumburg-Lippe. Schaumburg-Lippe was a postage stamp of a country, half the size of Prince William County, the county in which we're presently located, both in terms of space and population. So they only had one target there. Target. Never mind. That was a little anachronistic joke. Okay. Small country, and the curriculum there was very much about read a book, reflect upon it, a lot of writing reports, a lot of engineering work, a lot of project work, and organized on the tutorial basis, very similar to what you see at places like Oxford and Cambridge today. So that the students worked every once a week, you go, you have a visit with your tutor, maybe with one of your classmates, and you go over your project. So very, very intense project work, but very, very slow thinking and very, very thorough. And it was something I think today we would call STEAM. You know, you've heard of STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. This was STEAM with the addition, the A standing for the arts, that the present dichotomy, which I think is a huge, huge mistake in our most 20th century educational systems, of dividing the world of science, technology, engineering, and math from that of humanities. That rift had not happened yet. And so there was a lot of a project, for example, at this time, so we're talking about the time of the American War of Independence, so the late 1770s. The best book in the world on ballistics was in English. So it's like, okay, your task, cadet Scharnhorst, this week is to do a translation from English into German of this book about ballistics. Is it humanities? Is it mathematics? Is it science? No, it's all those things together. So after 4.5 years, I forget the exact time that Scharnhorst spent at this school, he had this tremendous education in this kind of slow, deliberate, thorough, well-connected thinking. And he thinks, well, I'm going to be an artillery officer. I'm going to be an engineer. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. And then something happens. The Count William of Schaumburg-Lippe dies. One of his cousins takes over the country, and he says, this is for the birds. We're spending a fortune on having a tiny army. I mean, we're like the smallest country in Germany, and there's a lot of small countries in Germany in 1779. So the Scharnhorst finds himself without a job. So he goes back to the nearby kingdom of Hanover, where he'd been born and where his father had served as a non-commissioned officer in the cavalry, and gets a commission in his father's old regiment. So now he's in the cavalry. And his commanding officer, Colonel Emmerich Destorf, sometimes called von Estorf, but it's the 18th century, it's cool to be French. So everyone sort of Frenchifies their name. And it's interesting, one of his descendants ends up commanding one of the units on the opposite side of us at Belleau Wood. And how's that for the small world department? And he's all about what we'd call small wars, what actually then called small wars, Kleinkrieg, La Petite Guerre. And he'd been involved in the Seven Years' War, what we call the French-Indian War, and very much in this guerrilla warfare that's happening along the border between the Kingdom of France and the German Empire. And at that time, the Holy Roman Empire. And he was a kind of guerrilla. And so he would sit like, well, let's go out for a ride. And they go to a ride, and he said, oh, by the way, so you see that village over there? Now imagine that if there's a force of enemy cavalry, they're coming from here. Suppose that's happening, you're commanding a troop of cavalry, what do you do? And young Shardhar says, well, thank you, sir, for that assignment. I'll be back to you in a week. Right? And the colonel says, no, not in a week, right now. And this causes immense pain to the young man. And he writes to his uncle, and he says, you know, this is driving me nuts. How I wish that the Count of Blessed Memory were still alive, so that I could use his methods. So here's, again, this guy who was this exquisite education, totally thrown for a loop by this requirement that he make up his mind right away. Now, we don't know how long it took for him to adjust. It may have been a matter of days or weeks or months, but we do know that a couple of decades later, when he finds himself charged with a school for young officers, now in Berlin in the kingdom of Prussia. This is King of Prussia, the King of Prussia in Germany, not the one in Pennsylvania, right? There's for some reason, why do I want to make jokes about shopping malls for some reason? Anyway, he includes both of these elements in the curriculum. On the one hand, there are lectures in philosophy, quite literally by a guy who wrote a book called Philosophy for Dummies. That's the translation. Right. A student of Immanuel Kant. So there's systematic philosophy, there's mathematics, but at the same time, he says, okay, we're going out to this big park in the middle of Berlin, and we're going to do what he called, what Colonel Estorff called supposing. Suppose that this is going on, what do you do? And this is what we would call a TDG. Now, I won't say that Estorff invented the TDG, because I've got references to them going back to the 2nd century BC, or one reference going back to the 2nd century BC. Machiavelli talks about them in his prints, and you know, written in the early 16th century. So, and the idea is been around for a long time, but this is the origin of a systematic tradition of using this kind of rapid thinking as part of military education. And it's very hard to find out about this. You see references to it, but because so much of this is verbal and interactive, the paper doesn't survive. So I'm relying very much on memoirs and going, oh, well, this is mentioned in the memoir, people are talking about this. Occasionally you'll find a note, a map, that sort of thing. So again, there's a bias in the history against this sort of thing. But I think that this is a big part of the history, not only of that German tradition, which plays a big role in informing our own experience with maneuver warfare, but also of many parts of the American tradition of maneuver warfare. Go down to Fort Benning, Georgia, in the 1930s, and you have what are called historical map problems, or map problems, and then historical map problems. Read the writings of General Breckinridge, for whom we've named our library. He's wrestling with this problem. How do we teach problems? How do we teach tactics by problems? So the evidence is there. You just have to dig for it. And so what I'm trying to do is rectify this imbalance, not to denigrate slow and systematic thinking. I'm not arguing against the Enlightenment, right? I'm not, you know, a capital R. Well, actually, I am a capital R romantic, but not in the intellectual sense. But I really see it as really my mission for the next 10, 20 years to promote understanding of and the practice of this kind of fast thinking. And there are, right now, for 10 years when I was at MCU, at the Case Method Project, I really emphasized these exercises based upon actual events. And I still emphasize that. but I'm no longer exclusively concerned about that, because I'm also thinking about ways in which you can use these techniques for engaging the problems of the future. And one technique is to have one of these scenarios, one of these situations, based upon history, so it's firmly anchored in a reality, and then to change some of the technology. So let's say, okay, we want to think about drones. What would the Battle of Wake Island have looked like if there had been drones? And the point is that, yes, you realize that once you start changing things and realize, okay, well, at Wake in 1941, if we had drones, would the Japanese have had drones? Would they have had counter drones? What would the Imperial Japanese Navy have looked like in 1941 with drones? But at least you have the starting point, that scenario. This is called variously a counterfactual case or a comparative counterfactual case, or please do not try this at home, the Eimensberger Verfahren. That's named for Ludwig Ritter von Eimensberger, who was an Austrian officer in the 1930s, who used that technique to develop the Panzer Division. He said, let's look at the tank battles from the First World War. And he did these detailed case studies of those battles and said, okay, well, the First World War, tanks went about 5 miles an hour. They had horrible gas mileage. The ergonomics were awful. You know, people, the crews are choking in the smoke. But now it's not, now the early 1930s, and now we have better engine suspensions, livability, reliability. What does that mean? And going really, really going from there. So these scenarios actually, ironically, can also be a technique for a kind of slow thinking, a kind of exploration, a kind of speculation. So I'm involved in two parallel projects. One is here in Quantico, two blocks away from here in the Gray Research Center. Every Thursday afternoon, except for the 4th of July and Thanksgiving and Christmas, when Christmas falls on that day, we gather together and have do some sort of decision game. So it could be a decision-forcing case based on actual history, something that actually happened. This week, for example, you are Benjamin Zeledon, general in the Nicaraguan National Army, which is an insurrectionary force rebelling against the government of Adolfo Diaz, and also in a world full of frenemies. One of those frenemies is someone well known to everyone in this room, Smedley Butler. And you find yourself on top of a mountain called Coyotepe, and you have two 15-pounder field pieces. You have a very qualified, very competent artillery officer working for you in charge of those guns. Here comes the train down the track, led by, you don't know it's Major Butler, but we know it's Major Butler, with 350 Marines, bristling with machine guns. General Zeledon, what now? Right. So we do decision-forcing cases. We do some tactical decision games, including some classics. Some things we found in the archives of various schools. So we do some of the decision games used by Moltke the Elder in the middle 19th century, by the unfortunate Count Schlieffen later, also that also shows how some of the traps you can fall into when you're doing decision games. When you cut yourself loose from history and you start saying, let's set up this game. I love a double envelopment. Right? I mean, who doesn't love a double envelopment, right? So it's a thing of beauty. So I'm going to organize all my games so that the solution is a double envelopment, even if it means that if I have to do violence to reality. So it's, what if the French, invade, from Nancy into Lorraine, we can do a double envelopment. Oh, but they've got five divisions there. Oh, well, let's just change it. Now they only have two divisions. Well, now we can do a double envelopment, right? So Whereas in the reality, you got three extra divisions. You know, you've just fairy dusted away. So we do a lot of these classic edition games on tap. We've got actually a number used here at the Marine Corps schools in the 1920s and 1930s, including a lot of really interesting. A lot of people haven't looked at these files because it says military law. And you're thinking, it's just a lecture on the Rocks and Shoals. No, there's a riot in Baltimore. What do you do? There's a riot in Cincinnati, and someone's broken open the National Guard armory and started passing out rifles. Now what do you do? So really interesting contingency planning exercises, but classic ones again from the era of James Carson Breckinridge. And we also do a lot of things experimenting with board games, tabletop games of various sorts. So last summer we did a series of games called Wee Robot. Little hat tip to Isaac Asimov. I once saw him in person at the New York Museum of Natural History, and he is as distracted as you might imagine him to have been. And that was actually a three-sided conflict, really a highly abstract, where people would deal with robots, and there'd be cards that would show you all the various things that could go wrong with artificial intelligence, or go right. Very much how to build robots, how to play with robots. That was a lot of fun. So we're experimenting. We also experiment with a technique that I've seen used off and on in the past 30 years, which is to take a commercial board war game and use that as an umpired game. That's to say, forget the rules. Just have somebody who knows how to play the game be the umpire and say, yeah, you're in charge of this side, what do you do? And the umpire moves the pieces for you. What do? Umpire moves the pieces for you. Using the graphics and the elements provided by this commercial war game, putting the rules aside and using that as a very simple way of getting a training tool. So we do that every Thursday afternoon, and then on Tuesday evenings and also Friday mornings, we try to replicate that online. And right now we're using Google Hangouts as a tool for that. It's not the best tool, but it's simple and it's handy. I understand that Google Hangouts is not long for this world. So we're looking at Adobe Connect. Actually, the program, Woody, that you just shown, that is now on the list of to be looked at if I talk to you after the session. Trying to do that online so that people from throughout the world, and we have people from Australia, from Canada, from Spain joining us. And that's an opportunity, I think, for anybody who's listening to this podcast is invited to come join us, and doing it in the online venue, and seeing how we can do the kind of exercise that Scharnhorst and Desdorf did in person, or in the countryside, do that on in the online environment. And then finally, I said we had two projects. We actually have three. We also do every once in a while a decision forcing staff ride. We go out to a battlefield. Of course, this is Northern Virginia, so of course there are Civil War battlefields, American Civil War battlefields. It doesn't have to be that. And do the same kind of problem solving, rapid problem solving, on the site, the actual place where somebody in the past tried to solve that problem for real.
Very good. Well, thank you. And the next question that I had for you, you had talked about fairy dusting, so I think it's very appropriate that we talk about this, because when you related the issues of TDGs with Schlieffen and the double envelopment, my perception is that we do that very often with our design of exercises in the Marine Corps in creating a red opponent that the MEF or the division or the MAGCAF, whosoever, is able to defeat and therefore, you know, be combat ready as a result of that exercise. So, Dr. Goodmanson, the comment on the Marine Corps recently directed that large-scale force-on-force exercises would be incorporated into all service-level training. MAGTAF Training Command is already executing this with some success, but also a lot of challenges as well. Additionally, recently, Commanding General of the 2nd Marine Division directed that the division would have a concerted effort to improve its Marine Corps combat readiness evaluation exercises with respect to feedback that is provided to the division CG that force on force provides for that exercise, the exercising force. In fact, he plans to take the entire division out to 29 Palms at some point in 2020 for a division level force-on-force exercises. From what we've seen so far, our experiences, and additionally the Army's experience out at National Training Center, the exercises are very complex, they're very costly, as you can imagine. So in your recent articles in War on the Rocks and the Wavell Room, you advocate for a focus on decision force and case study as a part of preparation for decision making in large scale force on force exercises. Would you comment on that and walk us through how you create these exercises for your students in a fashion that the battalion commander or the regimental commander or the company commander can replicate the same thing to prepare his or her unit to go on to ITX or ultimately combat?
So let's imagine two field exercises. One is one in which everybody is prepared. Everyone has lots of questions, a huge stock of questions. And these questions come out of the experience of having worked through a whole bunch of different scenarios, both historical and imaginary. But I'd emphasize the historical because, again, the historical is rooted in reality. So that when the expensive stuff happens, when you're using the fuel, you're expending the ordnance, you're bringing people together, doing all those things that make for a big exercise, everybody is learning. Everybody's learning because they've got questions. They go, "Oh, I wondered about that." You know, in my exercise, I calculated the length of this column. But in reality, the column is longer or shorter. So I thought people it would take so long to do this, but now it takes much longer or much less time. This refining of judgment happens if those questions are already there. And that then everybody who takes part benefits from this. Now imagine another field exercise in which everything is happening in the two opposing command posts, in which nobody is prepared. I realize this is an extreme comparison, in which most people spend most of the exercise really as passengers. And so you're driving along in your Amtrak and or your truck or your aircraft, whatever you're driving along in, and it's like, well, yeah, this is sort of like riding the bus. It's like riding the Virginia Rail Express. Like I'm a passenger. And interesting stuff, you know, there must be stuff all over. I see all this stuff, but it doesn't make any sense to me because my mind isn't prepared. So the my argument in making this comparison, like I realize it's extreme, and you rarely get, you'll never get that perfect dichotomy, that the more time all concerned, you know, from you know, the fresh out of recruit training youngest Marine to the most senior general, that the more questions they have, the more experience they have with all of these complexities, the more that they'll learn. So again, my argument is that if you want to get full value out of such exercises, don't have them very often, which again, because they're inherently expensive, and spend as much time as you can with these other exercises, which are inherently cheap.
So, could you walk us through, yesterday we went through
yes.
and we did the scenario in Nicaragua
yes.
from the early part of the 20th century. Can you walk us through how you prepared through your research and then how you prepared to deliver that that decision-forcing game via the case method?
Okay, so what I'm working on these days is techniques for quickly developing decision-forcing cases. That's to say, I'm an historian. I am happiest when I'm in an archive, taking bits and pieces of facts and figures and weaving them into a narrative, and you know, writing great big thick footnotes, right? The kindest thing a fellow historian ever said about my work was that my footnotes had footnotes, right? I'm upset that Microsoft Word only lets me fill half a page with footnotes, right? But I realize that most people, most Marines are not going to have the patience or the background to do that. So I'm trying to work on techniques for developing decision-forcing cases simply. So the one we did this week took a little bit of time to put together because I was working with the protagonist of the case, Benjamin Zeledon, is a hero in Nicaragua. And there's a bit of material on him. But most of the material I had to get, the information, by taking American sources and reversing them. So I did spend a lot of time in the archives. But the previous week, we did a case in which the hero was, again, someone well known to everyone in this room, Smedley Butler. And I had his letters to his wife, and I had The Old Gimlet Eye, which has been on the reading list for many years, available free on the internet now, which is sort of it's an adventure story written by Lowell Thomas, the man who made Lawrence of Arabia, Lawrence of Arabia. A bit of a showman, Lowell Thomas. So you have to read it with a grain of salt, if you can do that. But basically, using those two sources, The Old Gimlet Eye, and the letters, which are available online from our MCU archives, I constructed the story of Smedley Butler riding his train back and forth between various cities in Nicaragua, and then the challenges he faced. So essentially what I did was I made a timeline and said, you know, on 18 September this happens, blah, 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 something shows up, what do you do? And it's very simple. And what I'm recommending, particularly this is being done at McTaug right now, and I'm happy to say this is something I promoted, is taking the monographs that History Division produces, which are splendid. They're very well done, and they're very well suited for this. And using those as the starting points for decision-forcing cases. And quite literally, you know, photocopy a page or two from the monograph, find the protagonist, you know, usually a commander who's about to make a decision, read to the point where he makes the decision, cut it with a pair of scissors. I recommend you do this physically rather than doing it, you know, digitally. You just get out your scissors, photocopy it, and then up to that point, what do you do? What's your plan? Discuss it. What happened? Here's the rest of the story. It really is that simple. Now, of course, we can do that because if we're dealing with recent conflicts, and I recommend doing this really Vietnam forward. So we're talking, you know, about 60 plus years now, we know what the elements are, right? Same basic kind of rifle, same basic type of machine gun, same, actually, in many cases, same basic type of helicopters, which is rather shocking. But it's actually a very simple process. If you have the narrative, if you've got the story, and the story is told in a sufficiently neutral way, it's that simple. You take it, you photocopy it, you introduce the character. You are Major Smedley Butler. You are in command of the Panama Battalion, 3rd Battalion of the 1st Provisional Marine Regiment. Here's what you've got. Here's your situation. And you know, it helps if you can do it with a little bit of drama, a little bit of showmanship. But if you have to do it, read it. Stop now. Major Butler, may I call you Smedley? What's your plan? What do you do? And the question is very simple. What do you do? What are your orders? And you leave the discussion from there. And the trick is not to try to replicate the history. The history is your baseline. But to encourage the solution of the problem, the explanation of the problem. So, Major Butler, you plan on dismounting your machine gun, setting up a base of fire. Why is that? What are you thinking? What recommends that course of action? Ah, Major Butler, you want to put your train in reverse and go back to Managua. Why is that? By the way, this is a at least three-sided civil war. Could be four, depending how you count. Right? It's a very, very complicated situation, but the basic technique of creating the game is very simple.
Excellent. So, just based off of your articles, it was funny that you brought up Wake Island, because that's one of the scenarios that we're looking at, and there between the Naval Archives, between what Marine Corps University has put out there on the Defense Battalions, huge amount of information on it, and so it's not that difficult of a thing to do, I would think, if you know, you're a company commander trying to come up with a PME for your your squad leaders and platoon commanders and whatnot on an afternoon. So thank you for explaining that in detail.
Yeah. And there's another thing you can do. You could also, there's a variant which involves movies. Mm-hmm. And I realize that the world of movies is not the same as the world of reality. But I've done the speaking of Lawrence of Arabia, and I realize the movie takes a lot of liberties. But the kind of a very simple PME where you show a bit of the movie, and then you say, stop now. Major Lawrence, what's your plan? What do you do? And you show the rest of the movie. And again, this is not an exercise in guessing history. It's fun when your solution replicates history. There's an element of enjoyment there. And that sometimes happens. Sometimes the history is so off the wall that nobody gets it. And that's okay too. It's just that the history has a baseline. You know, there's an element of granularity that the terrain is real. Another quick pro tip for if you're making an imaginary situation, use real terrain. Right, just use a real map. It can be anywhere in the world, but rather than trying to invent one for yourself.
Excellent, thank you. I'd like to open it up to the group, those of you who are here, those of you who might be calling in right now on the conference call. Any questions, anything that you'd like to discuss or comment on Dr. Goodmanson's work or the things that he said today?
I do have one, sir.
Yes.
The current focus, at least in the infantry, is on the lethality of the rifle squad.
Yes.
Squad's king. Have you done any of these with sergeants, corporals, and what would you see as some adjustments you need to make to make those effective for squad leaders?
So here's a paradox for you. None at all. The I've done decision forcing cases with Marines of all ranks, from, again, young Marines straight out of their initial trainings, you know, straight out of MCT or School of Infantry, and with newly minted brigadier generals. I've also done these with children. Okay. Now, please don't write down that I've been experimenting with children. All right. But what I did really as an experiment, I once did, one of my favorite cases is called The Pied Piper of Saipan. And it's about the people who find themselves having to lead a Marine who is both very useful in the field and just a lot of problems in garrison. And I'm sure you've met them. And I did that at a Russell Leadership Conference with a bunch of selected sergeants and corporals. And I've done it with many groups since, but I've also done it with a group of young Marines who were, the young Marines, the youth group, ages 8 through 13. And the experience is the same. The range of answers, the way people engage these problems, is remarkably similar. So obviously with any audience, you have to give background. So what people assume, what the knowledge people bring in will vary. But again, I've done this with children as young as 8. And people of all ranks. I've done this with college students. I've done this with adult professionals at the Yale Alumni College, the course called Cases from Clausewitz last November. And the experience is remarkably similar.
That's good to hear, sir. Yeah. That is good to hear, because some folks' experience with this type of TDG case study method, sometimes the experience tends to be you lay this out and you get a bunch of blank stares back at you.
Yes.
and it's tough to get it going.
Yes. The problem there is not so much knowledge, but fear. And the trick then is to, one technique for getting over the fear is to start off with scenarios that are set in a time and place so distant from your own that they don't feel obliged to know. So pull something from the Viking era. Pull something from classical antiquity. Pull something from the warlord period of China. Whatever you've got written down, use that because if you ask Sergeant Jones about, this is something we pulled out of the Battle for Hue. He goes, this is my world. I need to know about this. I'm being judged. If you say, okay, this is from the Battle of Thermopylae, he goes, oh yeah, no one expects me to know this stuff. Let me start playing and get involved in the game. And then when you say, okay, now it's the Battle of Hue and we got to cross this street, and instead of, M240s, we've got M60s, but that's really the big difference. Then there's a degree of comfort, a greater degree of cognitive, or I'll say not cognitive comfort, emotional comfort. You want to create emotional comfort so that you can focus on the cognitive stress.
Oh, I appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
Anyone else?
So one of the critiques of TDGs is often limited context, and the participant's going to make one decision. As you were designing these cases, are you trying to put the decision maker through a series of decisions? And if so, how are you trying to design the case so that those involved are not just making one decision, but it can become a more fluid exercise and experience?
So if you'll excuse the East Coast-centric reference, there is a type of exercise I call the White Castle case. That's from the White Castle hamburger chain. So the So rather than having one big hamburger, you have a lot of little hamburgers, right? The little sliders, right? You make a meal out of the little sliders. So the a case or a TDG like that gives the consists of a series of problems that are in succession, that follow one another. And the one we did this week with Journal Zilla Dawn, I actually had a timeline of the problems he faced and then the decision, problems, decision, problem, decision. So the course of that, I think participants made 7 or 8 decisions. Could be more or not. And it's particularly good for problems involving, let's say, an advance to contact. And there's a great one, actually, from used at Fort Benning in 1930-something, which takes a company commander leading an advance to contact in August of 1914. He's a French company commander, French Marines, actually, Troupe Coloniale. And he's going into the woods. It's people don't know it's the First World War yet, right? It's August 1914. And he's going into the unknown, and things are happening. He's got to make decisions, and again, for the that exercise again consists of a good dozen decisions that he makes. So, and the other thing is when you're using your Marine Corps historical monographs, these little books that History Division puts out, that need to do. Pick them up off the first sergeant's desk. Pick them up, borrow them from the CO. Ask first. They're often well suited to that. So you can take that, and the simplest thing to do is to make a timeline. And again, what I'm doing is I love graphics. I love making graphics. I love making the maps and what have you. But really, with one map and a timeline, you can have a whole series of small decision games that all together make up a large decision game. So lots of decisions. And also, I think that will help you with the problem of people being a little bit shy about making a decision. Rather than saying, you got to make one big decision, make lots of little decisions.
Please go ahead. Could you talk a little bit about, along that same track, adversarial decision games, where it's not essentially a player against a problem, but it's a player against a player, where you have two opponents or more, two teams of opponents, because fighting's about emergence. It's the sum of the parts.
Yes, yes.
And so without that opponent, it's not really fighting, and it's not the sort of rapid decision making or thinking that we're talking about.
Yes. No. Right. So that they, if you're doing a decision game that's made up of a series of problems, you're dealing with one problem at a time, and you're dealing with as a problem, and you're probably not thinking about, you might be, but you don't have to really think about a living, breathing, calculating opponent. So there's also a technique, and very much out of this tradition, that we often use the German term Kriegsspiel for it. It's really what the Germans called a free Kriegsspiel, because Kriegsspiel simply means war game. And you can spell it with one S or two, that's okay. Where you have people in different rooms who are sending messages back and forth to an umpire, who is telling you what's going on. And that gives you that element of dealing with a living, breathing opponent. And more than that, if you started off historically, you then get that connection to reality. Now, of course, the further you go along the game, the larger the number of iterations, the further you get from reality. But that is a terrific experience. And the real problem there is finding the people who are able to be umpires, because that is a really tough job. And I would say that the the tactical decision game, the decision forcing case, are very good ways of developing a lot of skills for both the players and the umpires in that game. And that is, you know, it's a very, very useful technique, very valuable technique. But again, my experience, and also the experience of people, I mean, going back, people started doing this in a big way in the 1870s. Jakob Meckel, who ironically is the inventor of the bonsai charge, and ends up teaching the Japanese in the 1880s, starts promoting this in the 1870s in Germany. And everyone's saying the thing that stops us, the thing that slows us down, is the lack of umpires. But I think the way to increase the stock of potential umpires is to play the one-sided games, realizing that every simulation you use, including, you know, a force and force exercise in 29 Palms, is a simulation. But even the real thing is a simulation for the next real thing. That's one of the inherent problems. But the way we make progress towards solving that is playing a lot of these decision forcing cases and other kinds of decision games.
Thanks.
Again, interesting you mentioned that. We were looking at that specific issue of how do we as a Marine Corps train umpires, train exercise controllers when we first started looking at the force on force issue with 29 Palms, with Mountain Warfare Training Center, and in those exercises. And there's really not a lot out there. There's one book in the Gray Research Center, and it's an English translation from 1939 of a German publication on umpires. So aside from tactical decision games and things of that nature, are there any other recommendations or thoughts that you would have on umpires or exercise controllers?
Well, let me start by saying that the two umpires, Kriegsspiel umpires, people who are best at this, of the Marines on active duty, I've seen do this. One is a major, one is a sergeant. So it is, I think, independent of rank. And there is a certain element, like anything in life, there's a certain element of talent. But I don't want to say, well, just find the talented people, because that's it can easily become a cop-out. I think the thing is to do lots of TDGs, lots of decision-forcing cases, and then what will happen is you'll start seeing the desire to do this, and with the desire will come the ability. And the other thing is to experiment with, you know, various techniques of communicating back and forth. Sometimes you use the canaries, the little message pads, which we've been using for more than 100 years now. I've been in the archives looking at old canaries. You know, they're some things don't change. But also think about using your cell phone to take a picture of the map and move that back and forth. Experiment with teams of umpires so that one umpire, some people may be very good at documenting of saying, well, yes, this unit went here. Some may be very good at calculating. Well, the order was for, you know, this platoon of Amtraks to go 500 miles an hour. That's not going to happen, right? And some people are very good at communicating. And all these things, the really good umpire does all of those at the same time, and really in his own mind. So, but if you have a team, you can break out those functions. I think you can do better. But the other thing I'd say before you, because of the constrained variable is the umpire. The more experience participants have with the one-step games, the more they will get from that interactive opposing will experience.
Thank you. I think we have time for about one or two more questions, if there's anything else that anyone had today. All right. Well, seeing none, Dr. Goodmanson, thank you for coming today. Thank you for making yourself available to us and for what you've done for the Marine Corps for such a long time. I think one of the great things about you is just your dedication and your humility. I remember when I had made your acquaintance at EWS, it took me a couple weeks and pulling out my old copy of Stormtroop Tactics to figure out who you were. So
I'm still trying to figure that out myself.
So it's just greatly appreciated that you would have the time to come down here and you know, that to spend time with us and to be down here. So the last thing I'd like to do is ask, you know, for anybody who's listening, what's the best way to get in touch with you? Email address, if they're interested in any of the topics that you spoke about today, or interested in joining the case study group that you have, or in interest in eBuildUp.
Yes, so I'd recommend, first of all, my email address is a Gmail address. It's decisionforcingcase@gmail.com. So it's DFC spelled out, decisionforcingcase@gmail.com. I also have a website, actually have a series of websites that are all connected to what I call my gateway. And that is teachusmc.blogspot.com. Now I wish I'd called it learningusmc.blogspot.com, but it's teachusmc.blogspot.com. And unfortunately, because these are Google systems, and Google hates America, they you can't reach them with your government computer, so you have to use your own device.
All right, thank you very much.